I wrote you when I finished it, the Household War for the Cosmos. I mean, I get it. I mean, I like them both. I plugged them both this weekend in Apologia.
Nice. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
I did, actually.
Great.
But, I mean, like, it's stuff that nobody... I mean, you point this out, but nobody in our
coach
is getting it anymore.
Yeah.
Nobody's teaching on this. Nobody's explaining these basic things.
Right. Yeah.
And I honestly don't know of a better... better source, one-stop shop to those two. The guy, they have a mission, they just started a mission work, Apologia did, in Hawaii.
Oh, okay.
It's been going on for a year and a half.
Yeah. They just sent a new guy there, and he was doing a sermon series based on your book.
Wow. So, that's great.
Zach. Fantastic.
He got the idea, though, from the message that I did at Christ Church. He was watching my messages, and I explicitly mentioned your book.
I appreciate that. Well, you know, it's stuff that our ancestors just did. It was in their blood.
I know. And you people just knew or were taught. And we don't.
Yeah, the thing about it, with this whole Rachel Green stuff, I'm not going to waste any time reading her book, but just a little stuff that I get kind of through the grapevine, I'm just like... The reason why she's clueless is that she doesn't understand this stuff. No one's ever talked to her about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you think about sort of mainstream PCA, they don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. See, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. It's there are very few places. So you know, where I have friends, it's kind of funny. Obviously, here in Moscow, I've got a lot of friends here. The other places are in unexpected places you might not expect. The conservative Catholics love me. You know, they promote my stuff. They talk to me. They're nice to me.
Nope.
The PCA hates my guts.
Right.
They don't want anything to do with me. They walk out of the room when I walk in. You know,
the conservative Catholics, the same kind of thing. Like they have instincts that would lean this way, but have no teaching or no grounding.
Well,
but they're very involved in economics.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. The Catholics are the ones who haven't left the social square.
Yeah.
Catholics are still engaged one way or another, and it was amazing watching William Barr get up at Notre Dame and talk so Christian, right? Mm-hmm. And like, that's their
attorney general. So presuppositionally, except for his evolution stuff.
Well, take for example Patrick Deneen. He wrote The End of Liberalism. I was at Harvard listening to him give a lecture. He pointed me out to the entire room.
Really?
Yeah. Said, you got to read Wiley's book, Man of the House.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. And he said, we ought to have a center at Notre Dame that's focused on these things that Wiley's talking about.
Wow.
So that's the kind of support I get when I leave the PCA.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, here... And like I said, you know, there are certain places, like the whole Touchstone world, you know, they're very supportive.
Yeah.
Even I just did something for, I don't know if you know, a woman named Susanna Black.
Yeah.
She's at Plow.
She's in New York?
Yeah. Yeah, she just had me do something on my grow.
Is she Protestant or is she Catholic?
She's got a really interesting background. She was at Amherst, which is like a super hooper. It's kind of like Berkeley, but in Massachusetts. And so she was converted at Berkeley out of sort of a secular background through a kind of charismatic kind of thing.
Hmm.
But like when you're really smart and you're in a charismatic community, sooner or later you say people are insane.
I don't think I wouldn't even ask that.
Isn't there more to it?
So she's like, she started looking, you know, and so she's essentially, I think, an Anglican. But where she is, she's very, I think, sympathetic to the reform world. She's very supportive. She's also... involved in that. Like in New York, when I go down to New York, you know, people like Aaron's a friend of mine, Aaron Rim.
Yeah.
You know, they all know each other.
Yeah.
It's like when you're a conservative, socially conservative
you know each other.
Christian in New York,
it's a small crowd.
That's right.
Yeah.
It fills a room.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, right.
But the people who are in the room are incredibly influential in the sense of they're where they are.
Yeah.
So like when, you know, First Things, I've got friends at First Things. So when they do like one of their Erasmus lectures, something like that, when the room is full, those are the people.
Yeah.
You know. So Susanna's in the room, David Talcott's in the room, you know, Aaron Wren's in the room.
Mm-hmm.
He's all there. So I'll swing down because, you know, it's about an hour and a half drive for me. I'm in the city.
Yeah.
And
What?
So
I'm sorry.
No.
This is upside down.
And you know who's not there? Tim Keller.
Right. That's where my question was going to go.
And that's where I'm going too. Is just why when I came from a Reformed Baptist. So my walk is charismatic, hand clapping, speaking in tongues, following the Spirit. We didn't play with snakes. That's for the crazy ones.
That's for my ancestors.
Okay, yeah.
Western Pennsylvania, you know, West Virginia.
Okay. We didn't touch y'all.
Huh? That's from my world. That's where I came from.
Okay, so we did all of that. And then I go from there to Christian Missionary Alliance Church.
Oh, I know.
So that was a great bridge for me.
Yeah.
From Charismatic Christian Missionary Alliance, from Christian Missionary Alliance to Reformed Baptist.
Okay.
Right? And then from Reformed Baptist to PCA Presbyterian, from there now to the CRC, right?
Yeah, get closer and closer to the throne.
That's how I feel. But that jump from Reformed Baptist to Presbyterianism, I was so happy to find the PCA because I was like, finally some guts.
Yeah.
Finally some guys who, they had this foundation, this doctrine that I was in love with. I hadn't been to a church.
But you see, the thing is in my time, I didn't grow up Presbyterian or anything. I grew up in the Church of Scientology.
You know,
I've got a really weird background. I agree with you. Maybe 15 years ago, that was the PCA. PCA today is a bunch of people who are wannabe Kellers. That's it. That's all. They're just wannabes.
Wannabe Kellers?
Tim Keller. So with all these, I mean, like, you're just talking about New York and the conservatives find each other. Everyone gets in the room. And everything. So it seems like even the conservatives who get it are hungry for a vision from the pulpit of what it looks like for pastors to lead their congregation and engage in politics.
They're very disappointed in pastors.
How many pastors are in that room?
I like me. I'm not exaggerating. It's like me and nobody else.
Wow.
They're all editors. They're all professors. They're all people who are involved in government, stuff like that. But the pastors go to the conferences where Tim Keller speaks.
If you go to the Gospel Coalition or if you go for the Gospel or whatever that stuff is.
But I guess it seems like part of the hunger there is they want the unadulterated Word of God unapologetically proclaimed.
Oh, yeah. Right? They definitely want that. Like when you think of a guy like Robert P. George at Princeton.
Yep.
You know, or Tony Esslin. They're always talking about how disappointed they are in the clergy.
Yep.
Yep. Of course, they're Catholics.
Yep.
Why are there no? I mean, where are the pastors? I mean, why are they only at the Keller conferences?
Because they really do believe that being nice is going to save the world.
So, what do you think about John MacArthur and telling Beth Moore to go home?
I think. Well, I've not heard the video or anything.
Yeah.
But I think I get it. You know, she strikes me as kind of Barbie for Jesus. You know, I'm just like...
Message.
Cheers.
Yeah,
I'm
cheers.
And I think that her, basically, she really appeals to girls who want to look like her.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. It's marketing. That is absolutely right. I think it's... QVC.
Are we getting this on? I'm willing to say everything I just said.
Yep. Oh, we've been recording.
Oh, we are.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we've been going.
We just jumped in.
Yeah.
I didn't mean that.
No.
If you only knew while I'm making this doc, how many people
said it?
In fact, there's nothing I said I haven't said everywhere else.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So again, so they think that niceness.
Winsome is
going to win, but I mean, haven't they read their Bibles?
Very selectively, they've screened them.
Yeah,
but look at Keller.
One of the favorite. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
One of the favorite things that they love to quote, or one of the favorite verses they love to quote: "All things to all men, by all means win some."
Yeah.
So that just leaves a
trump card.
That's right. And that's like eight lanes coming out of New York City. You've got so much space in that, that you could do anything you want and say, I'm trying to be winsome, or I'm trying to be all things to all people. And so you just, for example, when I did U of I, when I did that that talk, there is not a single RUF, Reform University Fellowship, that in America that would have sponsored that. Not a single one that would
have toxic
the guts.
Matriarchy.
A single one who had the guts.
Right.
Part of the appeal is that Christians have suffered from the signs of success. They haven't really had it. Right? When you look at the PCA, their denomination has been dwindling for a long time, and they've been looking for a while for how do we become commercial.
And once Keller's like, Keller's that hero?
Not just a hero, but where he did it at.
In New York.
Where you shouldn't be able to do it.
Here's the thing. You know, if you've ever been to Manhattan is very deceptive. They're mostly kids from Iowa. Mm. They're people who are from other places.
They want the big city experience.
They want the big city experience. They're in Manhattan. So if you're in the Lower East Side, the Upper East Side, the Upper West Side, you can count on the fact that these are people from someplace else. They're from Iowa or Florida or whatever. The real New Yorkers grew up in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. or the Bronx, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. places like that. And that shtick doesn't work there.
Oh.
Really? Now that's unique.
Because you the common thing that you hear is from the Tim Keller and that world is that I'm reaching New York. Now, and really what is he's reaching imports.
Middle America?
He's reaching people who are expatriates.
Who are
from other places. Yeah.
Who are longing for coolness.
They're longing for coolness and mm-hmm. and
which is probably why they're in Manhattan.
Yeah,
already.
Yeah, right.
They want to be cool.
I need to get my town is not cool. My right. parents aren't as fun. Right. I need to go to New York and right. with all the bling and lights and blitz and everything.
Now, don't get me wrong. I go down to New York. I have a great time. Mm-hmm. I like going yeah. down there. It's an hour and a half drive for me. I go down there maybe three or four times a year. This, whenever I get a chance, I enjoy it. I was down there not too long ago at the Erasmus lectures, but first things and stuff like that. So, so I've got friends in the city and I enjoy it. But, I did urban ministry for a decade in Boston. And the people I know who are the old school urban ministry people, they're not impressed with Keller.
Huh. Why not?
Because of the things I just kind of described.
Because he's not actually reaching the people in the city. He's not actually reaching the city.
Now, the city has changed. There's been a lot of things that have happened. Like, when I first got into urban ministry, nobody wanted to live in the city.
Right.
I remember Times Square back in the day when they were making movies like Escape from New York.
Yeah. Right.
I was there. I remember, times when I would walk through the combat zone in Boston, I'd be propositioned like seven times in a block.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
That kind of world.
Wow. Yeah.
And I'd be in Times Square, same kind of thing. Now, we're getting that back, the current mayor... He's nostalgic for that period, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's kind of coming back.
Days.
But
oh, man.
That world that I knew was the world that a lot of the urban ministry guys that I knew from back in the day, they were in that world, and the people who for me have cred, street cred in that world. Oftentimes were people who were not looking for any kind of attention or any kind of support financially or anything from somewhere else.
The real hustlers, right?
Yeah, the good guys. So for example, if you go into a lot of, back in the day, and I think it's still true today in some of these churches, but you would never know about them in suburbia. But if you go into Philadelphia and go to Christian Stronghold Baptist Church, you would find a church with about 3,000 people and the church has no debt. They've had like... four or five different building programs, paid everything cash. These are people, like in inner city Philadelphia.
Huh.
So I remember one time, this is fun. This was like back in like 1992 or 93.
Right.
I was at his church, Willie Richardson. I don't know if he's still alive there now.
Huh.
But so it was a church made up of a lot of buppies. So you had a lot of black urban professionals, but also a lot of folks from the neighborhood. And there was a really strong emphasis on family and men.
Yeah.
Real strong emphasis on men and the need for particularly black men to provide the leadership in their homes and that kind of stuff. It was a very, very positive environment.
Yeah.
And so he'd get up, he looked like he was a CEO of Prudential Insurance. He was very straight. His sermon was like something out of a TED talk. But he had the designated whooper. Guy on a platform, this old black guy.
Come on, Pastor. Preacher.
Exactly.
Come on.
It's like it's almost, you could see the clock.
Hallelujah.
It's time for them to get up.
Yeah.
And then all the old ladies would be happy because he was doing his thing for a while. But it was brilliant because he had found a way to kind of hold it all together.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was talking mm-hmm. about, he was addressing sort of young families who were educated and were aspirant and were. Becoming influential in society, but at the same time affirming the roots of the community and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you would never know. There was no...
Right.
Like, remember
I've never heard of the church.
Yeah, you remember Tony Campolo?
Yeah.
Is that name?
Oh, yeah, Tony Campolo.
I remember I was in Philadelphia, and I was talking to one of these old guys. His name was Bill Crispin. Been around forever. He founded an organization called CUST, the Center for Theological Studies. And I, and it's just sort of in passing, I said, what about Tony Campolo? And he looked at me and said, Tony who? You know, that was the point. Mm-hmm. Tony who? Uh-huh. And I think a lot of people in the city say, Keller who?
Mm. Interesting. Interesting.
So, you know, you got to be in the scene to kind of get what's really going on. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just rely on the media. You can't rely on the Christian industrial complex, you know, Big Eva or any of that kind of stuff to know the truth. You got to get on the ground and get to know that. Like here in Moscow, you know, the situation on the ground is different than what people think it is.
Don't tell them.
But what I mean by that is this is this is a very healthy Christian community. I've been here a couple of times. I've been impressed by how healthy it is. Yeah. But people, they've been told a bunch of nonsense about this place.
Right. That's real.
It seems to me like because pastors have been so influenced by culture, that's what's seeping into the churches, as opposed to pastors trying to influence culture.
Yeah,
you know, we're getting it backwards, and of course, ultimately, it's the church we believe influences culture. But right now, we're getting
backwash.
Yeah,
because there's not enough pressure going out.
Yeah.
And I centrally want to lay this at the feet of the elders and the pastors because they're the leaders. But of course, the sheep have, you know, played their part in all this. But what's your approach to speaking directly into culture from the pulpit? Directly in culture, politics, that whole world.
Years ago, I was actually down at Yale at a place called the Overseas Ministry Study Center, and they had a guy who was speaking to missionaries, and he used a term that stuck with me ever since. This was like 30 plus years ago. The term was apostolic confidence.
Confidence?
Uh-huh. Apostolic confidence. You got something that other people don't have, and you need to tell them about it. So you're not looking to be, you know, slick or whatever. You're just looking to tell people about something that they don't know about, and to do it authoritatively. And so in my pulpit, you could say every sermon is political because Christ is king. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when I was at Harvard Divinity School, you know, one of the things, you know, you get there is this sort of the feminist and... But that's a whole story. I remember.
Give it to me.
I remember my first, when I registered. It's a really weird, different world. It's hard to explain to people. But when I got there, you know, first of all, one of the things that people don't, I think, have never experienced is just how powerful faculty can be when it's the old way of doing things. Mm-hmm. So, like at Harvard, you had to. Be signed into your class by your professor.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I don't know, is this something that you guys have experienced in other places?
No. I mean, University. I graduated from University of Idaho, and you didn't even sign in. I mean, they didn't even take roll call.
Yeah, oftentimes in public universities, you know, the administration handles all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But at Harvard Divinity, the professor, at least back when I was there, you know, he would have to or she would have to sign you into the class.
Actually, if she didn't admit you to the class.
If she didn't like you or he didn't like you, it's too bad.
Too bad. Yeah.
You know, so the first few, like the first week, you're going to class, you know, and you're trying to impress the professor. You know, you'd actually sometimes have to write a paper to get into the class.
Mm. Wow. So, but you could attend for a week in hopes you could get into the class.
Yeah. Now we had some really
trials. We'll see.
Wow.
So like Harvey Cox and you know different really high power, professors, public intellectuals were teaching these classes, and so people wanted to get the celeb factor. I remember when. Who was it? Oh, he was the director of Do the Right Thing, the old film. Remember the
Spike Lee?
Spike Lee. Spike Lee did a class for us.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
At Harvard Divinity?
Yeah, yeah. First day of class, he said, anybody vote for Reagan, you're not in the class. That's just it. It's like, you're not in. You know, when anyone raised their hand, you said, that's it.
He challenges your convictions right away, right?
Wow. Yeah, and so that's the kind of world, you know, that I was involved with for a period of time. But one of the things you saw all over the place is politics is everything. there's no such thing as something that's non-political.
No.
And in a way, that's wrong, and in a way, it's right, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, when I talk to my Catholic friends, they'll talk about something that's pre-political. What they mean by that is not that it's non-political. They're talking about natural things, like marriage and, you know, children, things like that.
Yeah.
But if you were to press them and say, well, didn't God make that? And they'd say, so, of course. But what that implies, of course, is that it's God's politics,
mm-hmm.
you know, the way God has ordered the world and so yeah. forth. But we live in a day when that sort of understanding is lost on us,
yeah.
that there's a sort of set of pre-established truths that God has ordained.
Mm-hmm.
So what we as pastors have to do is help people realize that in God's order, you know, there are certain things that are sacrosanct. I mean, they're just there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no, you know, boats.
and that's the apostolic authority or confidence that you're talking about.
Right. So whenever I talk about this stuff, like transgenderisms, I talk about this stuff all the time. That's the way I approach it.
Right.
You know, this is stuff that's been ordained by God.
It seems to me that a big part of what you do when you walk in, when you step into a pulpit, and I think this is going along with what you're saying, I mean, maybe in the first instance, part of what you're bringing is simply the confidence. It's like even before you get to the content of what you're confident about,
right.
it's just having confidence, which is a completely different persona
right.
than the guy who's the basically the Johnny come lately to every American fad. Like, we're doing screens now. Let's do screens. We're doing rock bands. Let's do mm-hmm. rock bands. Whatever the slick new thing is that will get people's attention to win them
right.
is a completely different tone. Like, of like, I'm trying to be cool.
Right.
Is a completely different tone to, I know the man. I know the one who runs this whole place.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a confidence that's grounded.
I know the one who mm-hmm. owns all of this.
Right.
And so it seems to me like that's the first thing. The pastor walks into a pulpit and just exudes.
Right.
Like, I have been sent here
right.
by the one who runs this whole place.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking to Nate the other day.
Yeah.
Nate Wilson.
Yeah.
He's talking about his documentary they did on, like, animal life. I can't remember what's the name of this.
Riot in the Dance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were out with sharks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was off the swimming with sharks.
Yeah. and David's not doing that. Did he pay you enough to do that?
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't do it either. But yeah. but it's all, I guess, a mind game, because what Nate was telling me is that this shark expert said if you make a lot of noise, splash around a lot, like that would be the last thing I'd want to do.
Yeah.
You know, I'd uh-huh. attract the attention of the shark. You know, he said. So, but if you make a lot of noise and then when the shark comes, you just look at it.
Yeah.
I'm in charge of you, shark.
Yeah.
The shark backs down.
Dominance, right?
Yeah, it's dominance. So you're communicating to the shark, I am the image of God.
I'm related to Adam.
That's it. That's
I'm the son of Adam.
That's right. That's right. I am made in the image of God, and you are a beast.
Submit.
You got that?
And
you got that?
But you know what? He told me they were out for like an hour or more, or maybe more. There's just like 30 sharks swimming around them the entire time.
Yeah.
And it's just like they're doing this again and again and again, and it works.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happens when you walk into a place like University of Idaho or whatever, you know, and you just and you're not you don't even you don't blink. You just say, you know, hey, this is the way it is.
That's
you think
that's
about
really
think about it's in Corinthians where. Paul says, you know, you have some teachers, but you don't have any fathers.
Mm.
I think pastoral ministry in a certain really important sense is a ministry of fatherhood.
Yeah,
but the problem is we don't even know what a father is. I know a lot of guys who wish they were a mother.
Yeah. Well, most of the pastors have children.
The way they address their children, and they want they want to be loved. They want to be nurture.
But isn't that whole like we want to win,
mm-hmm.
like people, and we want to be nice?
Yep.
I mean, isn't that basically the church trying to be maternal?
Well, and what I've seen again and again is that's like a formula for those guys in a sort of they're on a trajectory to apostasy. I've seen these guys just leave the faith. You know, they'll start off in a pretty okay place. They'll do the winsome thing for a little while, and then they'll get disillusioned because no one else is doing the winsome thing with them. they, and then they hate their
or because Winston doesn't work.
Maybe Winston doesn't work. Yeah. Next thing you know, they're working for the other side.
Yeah.
Well, the Winston thing is hard too. I mean, have you ever listened to one of those sermons from Stephen Furtick or T.D. Jakes? Those are hard to do. The gymnastics that you have to do in those sermons constantly is hard work.
Right.
And if that's what it's going to
You got writers. They have writers.
Right.
You got multiple writers for your sermon prep.
Sure. But I mean, even so, it's like the writers are struggling too. Like they can't. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to do.
Now, this is different than sort of the love that we should have for people who don't know the Lord.
Sure,
sure.
I was just with Jim Wilson today, you know, Doug's father.
Yeah.
And he was telling a story after story after story of how he had witnessed to somebody and they'd come to Christ and how important it is to love to somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's different.
Mm-hmm. But it's a genuine love. It's a true love. And I think in the way it's supposed to be is a man who loves. It's more like a fatherly love.
Yes, right.
And we just hung out with John.
I was just thinking
Barros.
Barros. This gentleman down in Florida. Who's been doing full-time
15 years
ministry in front of an abortion clinic in Florida.
Wow.
Every single day.
Wow.
Like all day long, I think is what
Times for the day.
He's like a missionary basically to this Planned Parenthood or whatever it is, the abortion clinic. He was very close friends with R.C. Sproul.
Okay.
Went to R.C. Sproul's church.
Right.
And in fact the very last what was it called? Renewing Your Mind.
Renewing Your Mind was the
Sproul
talking about John
Daily radio show.
Yeah.
The very last recorded show that R.C. Sproul did, he thanked a number of people who have been really, you know, influential in his life, and he was, you know, people doing ministry and, you know, people that he loved and was appreciative of. And then the very last person he mentions, he says, but you know, really, the person I think of the most is John Barros.
Yeah, I get up off my knees.
He says every morning I get up. And I with my wife, and I get on my knees and I pray for him.
Wow.
And the thing that he was telling us stories, you're talking about stories of the I mean, how many saves? I mean, he's like, I mean, hundreds.
Over 2,000 saves.
Over 2,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Over 2,000 people that he's, you know, pleaded with
to not
kill their baby. Yeah. And they've listened and saved their baby. But he told the story of the very first time I think he went when he was kind of considering maybe doing it full time, and it wasn't really want to.
Sure.
But he was there, called out to this gal. He says, "You just come sit down and talk with me for a little while." She comes and she sits down with him, and they talk for about an hour and a half. And at the end of the conversation, she just says, "Thank you so much. Huh. I'm not gonna do this." Leans over and kisses him on the cheek.
Yeah.
And then you know, keeps her baby. And it just struck me like, you know, he's you know, what, I don't know how old, is he 70 years old maybe? I don't know, I'd guess maybe in his 60s. Sorry, John. but the thing that struck me is he's being a father in a completely fatherless place.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Where fatherhood is maybe the most mocked and scorned in our culture at an abortion clinic.
And he's doing it in both ways, too.
And he does it both ways. Yeah, he's pleading with them in compassion. Don't do this. You'll regret this. There's somebody who can take your baby for you. Mm-hmm. But he also has hard words. We saw an exchange
clip
with him, and there's a boyfriend with the girl, and he's saying, you know, you're being a coward.
The boyfriend's dropping his girlfriend off,
and the boyfriend
walks in the clinic and then walks out because he dropped his
girlfriend. And he calls him a coward. He says, "You're being a coward," and the boyfriend starts cussing him out and everything. He says, "No, you're being a coward," and the boyfriend kind of like threatens him, and he says, "You won't do it.
You're a coward."
He says, you're a coward. I know you won't do it. And he basically did.
And he's in crutches. He's holding crutches up, saying, "You're a coward."
But it struck me like he's being a father. He's loving them, and at the same time, he's a brick wall. Like, he wouldn't budge.
Well, this gets us to the point of, what does it mean to love?
Yeah.
Does love mean gooey feelings?
Yeah.
Does it mean the warm, you know, glow? Does it mean the fuzz, the warm fuzzy? Or does it mean the hard truth?
Right.
You know, I think that that's entirely lost on us.
Right.
You know, we live in a culture now where I don't think any, because we don't believe in truth.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All that's left is feelings. All that's left is the goo. If there's no truth, there's no transcendent truth, then it's just goo.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's why we're willing to countenance all kinds of craziness.
Right, right.
If you were able to get the reins of the PCA or Southern Baptist Convention, whoever, and you wanted to turn this ship, what would you
do? If you were king for a day.
If you were king for a day. Because
what a glorious day that would be. Throw all the marketing crap out the window.
Yeah.
Just simply focus on the long game and just believe that the gospel is true and behave like it. You don't need to dress it up and all this stuff.
I think a lot of them would think that they're doing that already. Like the church that I was at, they would feel like that's what they're already doing.
I think you need to explain the long game.
Yeah.
What's the long game that would, where you'd say, okay, that's the long game?
Well, I think the long game is for one thing, it means generations.
Okay.
So it doesn't mean necessarily your church. In other words, you know, when we used to send missionaries to places like India and so forth, there would be people who would go there and die, not see a single convert.
Yeah.
You know? Right. And we just kept sending them. And now those are the places where we see tremendous growth.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by the long game. So it's if we're talking about bringing a message by its nature, because sin makes it difficult to accept or impossible to accept with our own strength, we ought to expect that there's going to be rejection. But we just keep coming, we keep coming.
So generations, though, I mean, that seems like that has to necessitate babies.
Yes, you got to have a pro.
I might be wrong here.
No, but even just as an example, at our church, Wednesday nights, they would have the youth service, and then sometimes on Sunday nights, they do a breakout. But if you went downstairs to see the service that was happening, it wasn't us. It was something else.
The service with the youth
was basically a Stephen Furtick service for the most part. The 3 points, the game,
MTV with Bible verses.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember going to our pastor and said, "Guys, if they're not singing hymns and singing songs the way we sing upstairs, how are we going to maintain them in our culture?"
Right. Yeah, right.
And you know what shocked me? It wasn't that they had an argument for me. It was the fact that they went, "Huh."
Never thought of that.
No. Don't do that.
You're the one that's supposed to be teaching me.
Don't you do that to me. You argue with me right now, mister. I want an argument while we're here. I don't want you to go,
I hadn't
thought about that.
A few minutes ago, I don't know if we caught this already on camera, but I just want to make sure you say it. You said Keller's church is a youth group.
Okay.
What did you mean by that?
Essentially, you've got a bunch of single people who are kind of pursuing their lives in a post-familial way. But basically, you know, you've got single people in their 30s and 40s.
No families.
That's right. Now, that's not something that Keller invented. That's Manhattan. So, you know, this is what I say to people. I'd like Redeemer better if it saw itself as a rescue mission.
Mm. Okay.
You know, so like I used to work in a rescue mission. I preached to drunk guys, and that kind of stuff. And we didn't like think, oh wow, we need more people living on the street for Jesus.
We were trying to get them off the street.
So we're trying to do Manhattan is like Disneyland. It's not real. It's really not. You know, you think about what does it cost to live there?
What a bizarre thing, then, to think, like, we're going to transplant that to churches all over the country.
Yeah, we're going to take, essentially, Disneyland and sterile people, and we're going to spread it to all of America. We're going to say...
That's a virus.
We would call that a disease.
Right, a disease.
So that's not a model for anything. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't have ministry there. I'm all
sure
for it.
Right.
But if we were thinking about this in the right way, we would say, you know what? Perhaps the most hostile place to biblical values in America is Manhattan.
Okay.
Not just in America, maybe even in the world.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so what we need, we need to have a presence here, but we got to recognize that if we're going to have families here, does that even come up? Now, I've not read Keller's marriage book. It'd be just too much work. And I don't think I'd get anything out of it, frankly. But so people who tell me they've read it say he doesn't talk about children.
Interesting.
I was talking to Glenn Sunshine. He said,
how can you have a marriage book that doesn't talk about children?
Now, I've not read it. Now, maybe Tim Keller will watch this video and say, I talked about children in
chapter
2 pages.
Yeah.
But
it's not a lot, at least.
It's not. Now, no one ever thought about marriage without children up until like yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, a couple weeks ago.
It was like, yeah, right. It's like the whole point.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, be fruitful and multiply.
Yeah, that whole thing.
Yeah.
So now, so this is not part of the apparent. Apparently, this is not part of the formula. You know, so what is marriage then? Well, marriage is apparently. Again, I've not read the book, so somebody could write and say, "Wiley, you don't understand." Whatever. Well, okay.
At least primarily,
yeah.
It's not about.
Yeah,
children.
This is some sort of way to sort of self-actualize or become holier or whatever. But that's not real for one thing, and it's certainly not the biblical, you know, framework for understanding marriage.
And it sounds like, again, it's short-term thinking.
Well, yeah, so let's talk about structural evil. Because these people love to talk about structural evil lately.
Yeah, yeah.
You've probably heard about this, you know, structural racism and
systemic. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Systemic.
Yeah. I'm experiencing it right now.
Eating that cheese dip.
In this room.
But what you have is, you have systemic evil in Manhattan. What am I talking about? To have a kid in Manhattan...
You can't afford it.
You can't afford it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, there are people who have kids in Manhattan, but they're incredibly wealthy.
Right.
My wife is a music teacher. She has a friend who commutes twice a week to Manhattan to teach piano.
Yeah.
Why? Because those people are willing to pay, like, 10 times as much for a piano teacher as they're willing to pay where I live.
Mm-hmm. Is Manhattan like China now or something?
Well, Manhattan is just an incredibly expensive place. You know, just.
I mean, with the two-kid policy or something? Or like,
well, this one's voluntary.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Okay.
This is the voluntary no-kid policy.
Yeah, right.
Because now, here's another sort of weird way it works. Now, if we think about, you know, sort of the state of the Catholic Church prior to the Reformation, we had a class of people who were the clerics, clergy, you know, nuns and monks and all these other people,
right,
who were, you know, completely devoted to the church. They didn't have families.
Right.
And they would say that their vocation was such that they couldn't have families. And so
right.
The Reformation, of course, you know, comes in and addresses that and says, by the way, Peter was married. Just all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
they do, like, these convent breaks. You know, like, literally, they were, like, breaking nuns out of convents.
Right.
Yeah.
They wanted to escape.
But the whole idea was, is, you know, they were thinking that celibacy was somehow, you know, sort of a higher level of Christian living.
Right.
Because it helped you to promote the work of the gospel at a level that people who were weighed down couldn't, you know, with children and responsibilities to a spouse. And so
I'm a sinner.
That's right. But now,
I could never be a pastor in that climate.
But what you have now is a sort of crazy, sort of reformed appropriation of this kind of thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
He's talking about Revoice.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, Revoice.
Right.
That's exactly
so what
you
got
right.
is this sort of thing where it's like, you know, I'm celibate for Jesus too, but I'm serving, I don't know, Monsanto or some Madison Avenue
Ooh.
Or whatever, and I'm doing the work of the kingdom.
Well, right. And there's actually several books out talking about and promoting the theology of singleness.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Now, you know, if you can't find a spouse and you really want one, I'm sorry. There actually are ways to address that. You know, we can do that.
Well, I don't think you're going to get married though.
Yeah, but that's the real thing. A lot of people don't want to.
Don't
get
even
married.
Want to.
Yeah,
right.
A lot of people don't want to.
I look at my friends and they look at their list for a woman.
Yeah.
I'm like, who are you talking about?
That's right.
Well,
right.
The logic, well, there's that. Yeah, that's.
I mean,
that's
really,
problem.
There is women. There
it,
are women
it
out stri- there.
It strikes me though that we actually set ourselves up for this when we made children optional.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
when we made children optional, we were already. Cutting the legs off of what marriage was,
right.
What marriage is for. But biblically, exegetically,
right.
You can't make a case in the Bible that that children are optional.
Right.
The only way you can do that is if you're reading the Bible in such a way that marriage is optional.
Right. Well, and you know, a few years ago, there was a book called Culture Making. Do you remember that book?
Yeah. Kraut?
I don't remember. I read like two chapters and I put it down and I couldn't pick it up again.
I think it was Crouch, maybe.
Anyways, when I read the book, I said, this is not about culture making, this is about being artsy.
Ooh.
That's all it was about.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an artist.
Winsome.
Yeah.
I mean, winsome.
Artsy, winsome.
Yeah.
So, but what is culture? Culture is cultivating, and what we're talking about is actually, you know, things that help us to develop and nurture and prune and whatever human beings.
Yeah.
Right. You have to have people.
You have to have people. Yeah. Yeah. The culture.
But one of the, yeah, if you want to
culture is about making people.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That. Yeah. Yeah.
Intergenerationally.
Yeah. You can't make culture if you're not making people.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So what we're talking about here is not culture. We're talking about some kind of, I don't know, sideline or personal, yeah, you know, sort of hobby.
Chris, well, you can't even put words to it. You know what is happening.
So you've written some on how central, how significant the family is in the purposes of God. You
right.
have a book, Household and the War for the Cosmos.
Right.
The War for the Cosmos?
Right.
I mean, you know, really?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, when we think about the cosmos, we usually think about Carl Sagan or
right.
somebody like him.
Right.
Billions and billions of years.
Right. Okay.
You know, but when we, the Greek word just simply means order. So the word world that we translate world, yeah, like in John 3:16, right, is cosmos.
Cosmos. Yeah.
You know, so it's the order. So there's an order that God establishes. That's the world that God loves. And then there's a world that we establish, and that's the world that God hates.
Ah.
So, you know, like when we see passages that talk about
loving the world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's hatred toward God.
Yeah.
That's the world that we have made,
yeah,
and the order that we have made. Sinful
mm-hmm.
men have made. And, but the order that God has made, that's the order that God loves. And so that's the cosmos. Now, we have a microcosm in the household. It reflects the macrocosm, the cosmos. So like when we think about, you know, when we talk about Christ and the church, we talk about the bridegroom and the bride.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, wouldn't you know it? At the microcosm, there's a bridegroom and a bride. Right. So, like when we read Ephesians, you know, we see the Apostle Paul, and you know, at the very end, talking about the household code, and
right,
when a wife submit to your husbands, as
right,
you know, and so forth. Christ, you know, the church submits. You know, all this
husbands
kind of stuff.
Love your wives as Christ loved the church.
Right. That's all that stuff is there.
Yeah.
So with these things, it's not like Paul was saying, but how should I say this? What kind of good
What's
metaphor?
A good analogy? Yeah. A metaphor.
No, it's not the way it works.
Yeah. No, as he takes a puff from his cigarette.
I know, man.
I'm going to get gritty here.
Yeah, Roman's really into marriage. Yeah. I'll use that.
I can relate to that.
Yeah. How can I be winsome about this?
That's right. But that's exactly the framework or the lens through which most modern preachers see that.
Yeah.
They think that Paul is just pulling something out of thin air.
Right.
It's something he said, well, I think I see something here. But it's just Paul.
And, it's reality. Like you're right. saying, like he's just saying, this is the way the world is.
This
ordered.
Is the way it is. Yeah. And if you want your household to reflect the cosmos, think about it this way. If it doesn't reflect the cosmos, if the larger order is at odds with the micro order, mm-hmm, what does that mean for the micro order?
You're in trouble.
It's arbitrary.
You're in trouble. You're dead.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any basis.
You're going to lose to the big order.
That's right.
Yeah.
So today, the way we think about the big order, we think about it like a machine. We think of it in mechanical terms, and
or evolutionary terms, which is like a machine. Ultimately.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so that has actually seeped into the household. Mm. So now people in their households think about just what they want out of them, and there's sort of
right.
conflict of interests and things like that. There's no sense of common good or common interest,
right?
No common life. So everybody's sort of at everybody's throat all the time,
right,
you know, wanting to get what they want.
Right.
So, but that's a fantasy, because what you got there is an incorrect understanding of the cosmos, but it filters into the microcosm, the household.
Right.
So what we need is recover. So we can't have like healthy microcosms and a wacko vision of the cosmos.
Right, right.
We got to have these things in harmony. And this is not something that was at all out of, you know, sort of step with the way people thought in the ancient world. This was the way they thought about everything.
Right.
And everything was sort of like, it was like Russian nesting dolls. I use that illustration a lot.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you got the big, then you got the smaller, then the smaller, then the smaller. And even us at an individual level, the way the ancients would describe us as people,
mm-hmm,
we were a microcosm. So like if I were to look at you, Gabe, I'd say you're a microcosm of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Like that picture of, is it Da Vinci, of the man,
yeah.
The human being kind of stretched out. Have you ever seen that picture
of him?
Yeah,
yeah.
Like, but it's like, he's in a sense saying, this the way that God is made, or I don't know, if, the human being is a microcosm of the universe.
It's amazing when you say that because the image around it is round, right?
Yep. Yeah.
It's circles. So
we're a small microcosm.
Right, right.
But the whole idea of the we're to rule our passions,
right?
Rule our feelings.
Right.
There's a hierarchy that's established.
Yeah, there's a hierarchy in the person.
That's right. So we've lost that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why, in so many churches we're all about feelings, because we don't really believe that there's a hierarchy in the person.
Right.
In the age where everybody's trying to get power, it's amazing to me they're denying the very idea that God has given for power to exude from, And when we got done, my wife and I got done with your book, we said, I wish we would have had this before we got married, right when we got married.
Yeah.
Because we had no idea how powerful our marriage was.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Like a healthy marriage that reflects the cosmos is a sermon.
Yeah.
Your household is a living sermon.
You're preaching.
Just by doing stuff.
So explain this. So you have a great section in there where you are describing the role of authority. And you point out that if you accept sort of this evolutionary or machinery vision of the cosmos, then basically the household reduces to a whole bunch of roommates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then randomly God says, you, the guy, you get to be in charge.
Yeah, yeah.
And functionally means he gets to control the remote. Basically, why? Because I'm the boss.
Yeah. That's right.
Which is understandably, and I think a lot of feminists and egalitarians, that's all they can hear. It's just like you're just saying, "What lucky winner you? You have male genitalia, so you get to have the remote.
You're the biggest and the strongest guy in the room,
right?
Yeah.
What is it really all about?
Right. Yeah. When the problems, feminism is a fairly recent phenomenon. Yeah. I don't think people sort of really reflect on that.
Yeah.
It's a product of sort of the modern world.
Yeah.
And I think it's a symptom of the sickness of the modern world.
Oh.
It's not like some kind of great thing that we've been traveling toward forever, and suddenly now we're in this happy utopia.
Yeah.
What you just described is just that. If we really think about this as sort of matter in motion and things in conflict and all that kind of stuff, then it's just the biggest and the strongest wins. Well, then there's really no basis for the authority apart from just, you got to do what I say or I'm going to hurt you.
Strength or raw strength, whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And so then they're going to be try to manipulate.
And they're going to resent it.
Yeah.
They're not going to see it as a gift to them.
Right.
That kind of thing. So in my house, I can beat my wife in arm wrestling 10 out of 10 times.
Yeah.
And that's not a big, I'm not bragging. It's just fact.
Yeah, yeah.
But what does that imply? Well, does that imply that that perhaps maybe I've got a responsibility to do certain things for her?
Mm-hmm.
If we don't think in those terms, we don't think that this has all been ordered and it sort of reflects a larger reality, then we don't think in those terms. We think, we say to ourselves or maybe even to our wives, well, you just take care of yourself.
Right.
We're all in this, you do your thing, I do mine.
And that's a lot of that is coming from because we don't understand the intention of the big order.
Okay.
Meaning that, what is the big order? Who am I within that big order, and what am I for?
Right.
When we define marriage and roles on marriage based off arbitrary means, and we don't have it anchored in God's intention in the big order, then we're gonna get all sorts of cattywampus out of that.
So what is family for?
Yeah.
What's it for?
That's the glory of God, of course, but in the sense that what we reflect is the order of salvation, and the relationship between God and the church. And, in a traditionally in a marriage, the way it was, you think about what people do today is they have prenuptial agreements.
Uh-huh. Right.
What in the world is that? It's basically saying I've got an escape clause that allows me to retain my assets. So are we actually one flesh? No.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
We got that because pastors have an escape clause.
So historically, this is why a divorce was so difficult, because what it meant was tearing something apart that had been one flesh.
Mm.
How do you do that? I mean, like when I think about my relationship to my wife, you can say at one level I bring in like 90% of the income in the household, but does that really reflect the household?
Right.
There's so much of our household that my wife is involved in that really is priceless. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't put a number on it.
Tell me about it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Right.
Yeah. Well, and she is the only one that can make the people.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's it. And do we pay her for that? Yeah, you know, yeah. That'd be almost sacrilegious, I would think, you know, blasphemous to be able to put a price on people.
Right. It seems like that's one of the things that we've lost is back to the idea of making culture. It's essentially making people, but understanding that the most valuable thing in all the universe is people.
Yeah, yeah.
Like there's nothing more valuable because there's nothing else in all of creation that bears the image of the maker.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And what is that? Well, it's all the things that go into making people human. Like, right. You know, our creativity, our intellect, our ability to reason and communicate, our artistry, making music. I mean, we really do reflect
God.
The infinite glory and goodness and beauty and creativity and ingenuity of the living God.
So, like my wife is like the uber feminine, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, so here's my wife. She's a beautician. Mm-hmm. And a kindergarten teacher and a music teacher.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, like the uber family.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know? She's got the trinity there.
So now she's in Denver right now, and we were on the phone tonight. She said, I got to hold the great niece. It was like the thing that she flew to Denver
to hold,
so she could hold the niece.
I mean, I'm every day holding this baby for hours, just holding the baby. I'm like, that's beautiful.
Fantastic.
I don't want to hold the baby that bad. You know? I like holding the baby a little bit.
Yay, babies. Yay, babies.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, there's something beautiful
yeah.
when you see a woman yeah. who loves babies
absolutely.
And is just completely absorbed in it.
Yeah.
You know, she's... So my wife is, does she care about whether or not people give her credit for that? No.
No.
Yeah. No. Or pay her for that? Mm-hmm. No. She's mm-hmm. just, there's something beautiful.
The reward is in the work.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there, that job is glorious.
Mm-hmm.
And we've lost sight of that because we've lost sight of a long-term mm-hmm. picture of what culture building, culture making actually is. And the man then, we've lost a vision, pastors and men in general, of how powerful that is to raise a family, mm-hmm. a number of children who then grow up, who are healthy, who are strong, who are intelligent, who love Jesus, mm-hmm. and who have been trained to go into the world mm-hmm. and invent and create and discover and build.
Well, and you know, and just, you know, when you think about my wife, and I get back to my wife.
Yeah.
Everyone loves my wife except Dykes.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
You know, so like old people love my wife, little children love my wife, other women love my wife, I love my wife. Everybody loves my wife.
Because she's a standing sign of what they were actually supposed to be, to be.
Yeah. And she's also able to do things I can't do.
Yeah.
Like, for example, like when we get a new neighbor, my wife's over there with, like, the dish.
Yeah.
And they see her coming, they're like, come on in.
Yeah.
They see me coming. Ooh.
Yeah. Pastor.
There's a guy with hair in his face. Yeah, right. You know,
it's a man.
It's a man. Who knows what that guy's going to do?
Exactly. Yeah.
He's dangerous. Yeah. He's a shark.
Yeah.
You know, so people just get on their guard. But my wife, she just walks in the room, and everybody's like, ah.
Yeah.
Ah, somebody we can talk to, someone we can, you know, trust, and someone we can, mm-hmm. you know, like, and stuff like that. People are like with me, they're like, oh, maybe I'll like you after a little while.
Do you think there's something in part of, this comes from our culture, part of what I felt like we've lost is the fact that I'm not going to get the glory in enough time in my lifetime. Giving your life to kids.
Yeah.
Giving your life to marriage.
Yeah.
Especially if you haven't had generational marriages that have been there before, or you know, so the blessing of God, and you see it over three or four generations of marriage, like, wow, they got this thing going.
Yeah, right.
Someone who's not there, maybe one or two generations or in, or not even one or two, they can look at like, ooh, I'm going to be the one dying here.
Right.
Right. And it doesn't look appealing at all. And so the hard work, do you think that some of the hard work that it takes to raise children are like, I'm not going to get there. Maybe they'll get there. Good luck. I'll give them the best I can.
Yeah.
And so that might be part of it, because in our culture, divorce is just rampant.
Yeah.
So I think this is a short-term, long-term
problem.
But I mean,
short-term glory rather than long-term glory.
But is there, that's what I was going to add, is there something in the middle of that where it's like, but that's actually even effective now, even though there might be a payout that's bigger.
Yeah.
There's some glory in this now that we should be looking to as well, right? Like, that's not...
Yeah, well, like with my wife, I was just, you know, use this illustration of her with her great niece.
Yeah.
You know? So obviously, her niece, my niece as well. So this is my great niece. It's funny. For my wife, she's just completely in the moment. You know, she's able to sort of enjoy the pleasure of loving this baby.
Yeah.
You know. That's something that I think some people are better at than other people.
Mm-hmm.
So,
sure.
You know, I think some people maybe need a little extra encouragement, maybe a little extra sort of, maybe they need an example.
Yeah.
You know, somebody they can look to and say, oh, wow, look
that's
what they've got.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then maybe there's some mentoring that can go on. So, like, my wife is also like the queen bee of the pastor's wives in our area.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, she's got like 30 pastor's wives that all kind of buzz around her all the time, uh-huh, looking for right, advice right, and stuff right. like that. And my wife is one of the most unassuming and modest and humble women you'll ever want to meet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's just that way.
Well, you're going to get a huge hug when you get home.
She'll never watch this.
She's doing
babies. She's doing bigger things. Yeah, yeah.
It's like every once in a while she checks on me, what did you do today? Oh, okay, that's nice. I
bet you're trying to get a big steak or something.
Yeah, she's so wrapped up in her stuff.
I'm making brownies.
And these are for you, not the neighbor.
That's right. It's never for me.
I can vouch for this. We went out to dinner with Chris and his Marla, right?
Right.
My wife and I did, and it was perfect timing. The Lord did it just perfectly, because we were in the process of selling our house, and our basement flooded that day.
Oh wow!
And we had people staying in it. The Longshores were staying in it, and they're like, he's like, yeah, there's water in the basement. We went over there, and we're like, oh, there's water in the basement. We're supposed to sell in a week. And then we're like, we got dinner, so we just ran over and had dinner with the Wileys, and it was beautiful. And your wife actually it was totally what we needed, and she was just such an encouragement to my wife. But that the thing that I think we miss though is that work is cosmic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
That work of encouragement. And being a woman that God has made you to be.
Holding babies.
Or being a
baking
man.
Baking brownies.
Or being the scary man,
uh-huh,
who's protecting that woman.
That's right.
Who's providing for that woman.
Right.
Is we are cutting with the grain of the universe,
mm-hmm,
the way we're made to be.
Amen.
And it's huge. It's mm-hmm, long-term. It's cosmic. And I think I go back to... I mean, why is it? I mean, you're right. Feminism is a fairly recent thing, mm-hmm, but you have, in basically late 1960s, a very concerted effort, like explicitly,
sure, yeah,
to take down the family,
yep.
to take down men,
yep. Mm-hmm.
And we now have actual records. Mm-hmm. Of people sitting in rooms planning this.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Saying, you know, we will go after the family.
When I was at Harvard Divinity School, there were...
When was that? What years?
That was in, like, 96 through 97.
Yeah.
I would go down the hall and see on the bulletin board, announcements for meetings to infiltrate the Southern Baptist Convention.
And they did it.
Wow.
See, this is the thing that people
97.
Don't, yeah, this that, is not, well, and I've got stories that go back farther than that.
But that's the thing. I read.
There's the people in those worlds are so naive.
Yeah.
Incredibly naive.
In the SBC.
Yeah. Well, not just them, but just
all of us.
And yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things is when you've lived in Cambridge or Manhattan or some of these places, and you go out into the rest of America, and you say, you know what, this is what's coming, and they look at you and they're like, you got two heads.
Yeah.
And they can't accept it. They don't want to believe it.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And you say, "But no, it's really coming."
I
can see this world that we're living in coming, like in 1995, 94.
We just can't believe people would be that wicked,
right?
Well, I mean, they did this with the public schools. I mean, John Dewey, explicitly said, we will have these public schools in order to get kids away from their parents and their pastors.
Well, and their fathers, right? Especially because we don't want to make them like their fathers.
And we need to get them out so that we can train them.
Let me give you a couple stories. There's a guy. I've got a guy you got to have on the show. His name is Brian Kamiker.
Okay.
He's Jewish.
Okay.
He's the founder of Mass Resistance. I don't know if you've ever heard of
it. I have heard of that.
Yeah, Mass Resistance. He's the founder of it.
Okay.
So Brian asked me to help him out with something in Massachusetts called, this is where the term Mass Resistance comes from. Now it's nationwide.
It sounds like a George Soros Antifa-funded thing.
Well,
yeah. Mass Resistance
is about as far away from that as you
can. But, it wouldn't be so obvious, actually.
But he has something called the Parents' Rights Initiative. Okay. That he actually was able to get legislators in Massachusetts to take, and so it became a bill. And I was there at the, you know, the hearings, you know, in Beacon Hill in Boston when this was being considered.
Yeah.
And there were people from, you know, the public schools, teachers, people from the teachers union who were all against it. And there was, and I remember a guy who was a teacher. I can't remember from where, what school or anything like that, or even the subject, but he made that argument explicitly. The goal of an education is to get kids away from their parents so that we, because their way of thinking is that the sorts of things that parents might do to children or in terms of how they raise them are not helpful or beneficial, and so we need to be prepared to intervene and take these kids out of it.
That was the goal. The goal was to get them out, and then they would retrain them.
Right.
And the thing that I keep thinking, though, is they, you're right, we're so naive. They say what they're going to do,
and then they do it.